CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Hubert Van Niekerk will be giving us an update on ECC. So what's the latest happenings with ECC?
Yeah, we've been quite busy, Cam. We came to different projects with the university, and British Columbia is keeping busy and organizing. And the Global Learning Exchange is coming to Canada in 2026, so we're on the planning committee for that. So maybe I can start with what's going on at Western University, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so in the last group, we're working with several groups with different classes, and most of it's called the Global Learning, or the Community Engaged Learning. And so they have different projects that they want us to work on. And we sort of designed a project. They have a guideline that we work with them to come up with good results. And so we just completed one that was with, they created, the biggest thing they did was create a sort of an ebook that could be easily read, easily accessed. Through the internet. We haven't launched it yet. We're kind of waiting for the right time to do that. And it's also going to be a link to a petition that we're going to be starting for a national disability case plan. And lately we have, we are still just about completed another project, which is called the Poster Project, at a computer science class, or classes. They created 100 posters for the Canada Accessibility Week coming up in 2025 and 2026. So they narrowed it down to 100. Our task was to narrow it down to the top three and then down to the top 10. So we've completed that now as of today, and we're waiting for feedback. I think all the posters could be changed if need be. And so we're looking to work with the final or poster that we can use for the Accessibility Week in 2025-26.
So
we have three other projects on the go with Western University. One is pretty much strictly the differences between Canada and U.S. in regards to disability care and support. But they're looking at the two different countries and how we can leverage that one, perhaps, to make things better in Canada.
So
the other one is looking at caregivers between the U.S., Canada, and Australia. A big piece of supporting people with disability is caregivers. And many caregivers are unpaid. So we're looking to see, we would certainly, with our National Disability Insurance Plan, be sure that caregivers get paid and don't lose the ability to collect a benefit pension plan when they retire.
So I'm curious. You mentioned the petition that's going to be developed. How do you plan on reaching out to the public and disability society to let them know that they should be lending their support, that they can get behind this?
Yeah, part of our plan, I mean, everything that we'll do is try to do it all in one big bang with social media. Hopefully the newspapers and the radios like yours will get involved. The question we'll be setting up, or hoping to be able to set up, booths at the university to collect signatures. And we do have MPs, nameless at the moment, but we do have MPs that will sponsor the petition in Parliament. So that alone, once that's read in Parliament, will give us certainly some coverage. And the third group that we're working with at the moment is actually Ivy School of Business. And they're working on kind of a business plan for fundraising and also media and marketing strategy. So we're hoping they'll come up with a plan as well to be able to get us out in front of the public more so and spread that message. You know, I haven't really said it in a sentence yet, but what we're all about with Every Canadian Counts is that we're looking for a publicly funded national disability insurance program for all people with long-term and chronic disabilities. That's basically what it is in a nutshell. People are disenfranchised. They're living a nightmare trying to get services. And disability is not their fault. And there's no reason why the community at large shouldn't be the ones that pay for that. The individuals or the family shouldn't have to pay for that.
So, do you find that working with university students in particular, that there's a benefit in reaching out to young people about these matters so that as they go forward, they'll have a better understanding of what the need is and how they can be an influence on it, make real change?
Absolutely. It's a highlight for what I do. It's, you know, as you know, we're all volunteers, and Cam, he felt so capacity as well, and working with students just energizes every time we talk to students. Sometimes it's eye-opening, but since 27% of the population has a disability, most groups that I work with at the university either themselves or know somebody very close that has a disability, so they're very eager to try to come up with a solution.
What are the next steps forward, next immediate steps?
Well, I mentioned out west, we're looking at the possibility of starting a pilot project with a disability insurance idea in British Columbia. There are some very key people that are very interested in looking at this further. So instead of, you know, we're going to keep going at it from a national perspective as well, because this should be national. But there's certainly nothing wrong with starting with a province and doing the studies that are necessary, the research that's necessary, and then have that type of experience built around through other provinces or to the national level. Yeah. At some point, the government is going to have to pick this up and say, this is a great idea, we need to do it. Yeah, I've lately had, you know, we're still involved with the Canadian Accessibility Network, which is a network of about 120 organizations. We're part of that. I met, you know, with different organizations, including Disability Without Poverty. Met at a Zoom call with Accessibility Canada directorate. They're looking for input from organizations and individuals for creating a roadmap for an accessible Canada. And, you know, I was quick to note there that if you want a roadmap, all you have to do is follow our roadmap for a national disability insurance plan. And that will solve so much of the problems that individuals are having, whether it's, you know, access to money and support is the first thing that people need to have access. Having access at the train and having access at the airplane is one thing, but we need access for people to even get out of their house, people that are have mental health issues, issues with the way buildings are built. people can't even get out to where physical access is a problem. There's all these other access issues as well.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, if anybody's interested in getting involved, just go info@everycanadianaccount.com, and that'll reach me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Archie Allison will be giving us an update on Variety Village. So what's the latest with Variety Village?
So Variety Village has been very busy. This is a very busy season for us. We've just finished the 2.0 tournament, which had almost 900 athletes participating last Sunday. The week before, there was weightlifting competition. We've had bolt hockey tournaments at Variety Village and in Barrie as well. Our swim teams have been training hard and getting ready for their first meets. Each of our teams are really kind of taking a focus on getting ready for their competitions that's coming up, including wheelchair basketball, bolt hockey, weightlifting, taekwondo, track and field, and others. So we're pretty excited about the season ahead for our teams. For our event season, a lot of them are tournaments and competitions. But we also just held the Active Living Conference with over 200 students from across Ontario participating to learn more about accessibility and inclusive participation. So that was very well received with our community partner support to introduce games, activities, resources, and support to students across the province. So there's quite a few things happening in our timeline, and our programs are very busy. Our event calendar is booking up and getting busier too, and our teams are getting ready for the upcoming competition season.
So, it's curious, you mentioned about raising awareness of accessibility among students. What do you think are some of the benefits for the community as a whole learning about accessible sport and the benefits therein?
Great question, Cam. I find the feedback that we get from students is they don't always have opportunities to learn about resources, information, networks, and opportunities to get involved. So the big piece around the conversation with the students is to introduce conversations to ensure that accessibility and inclusive participation are top of mind, a priority rather than a consideration or an afterthought. So as the students start to get more involved through participating in sport, through guest speakers, and through meeting the different exhibitors that were on site to promote their programs and services, what we're finding is that all the students are actually coming back saying, first of all, they didn't know about most of those opportunities. And the second part is the majority want to get involved and they want to make a change. They start to realize and recognize the impact of accessibility and how it impacts them, their families, and friends as well.
So what are some of the benefits for the athletes participating in larger scale tournaments like the ones you mentioned?
Yeah, for our athletes at Ready, we are very focused on team. So everybody is welcome, everybody's involved, and everybody's active in what we do. So as our athletes train throughout the season and get ready for competition, this is a chance to highlight their skills, their technique, and their speed or strength in their sport, and really to be recognized as an inclusive team that promotes various abilities, various skill, experience, and exposure to sport. And it brings us together to kind of recognize how athletes with disabilities are represented, participate, and play or compete in their sport too. So for many of the competitions we go to, they are inclusive by design and welcome athletes of all abilities. So when we are at the meets or competitions or tournaments, our athletes are really representative of sport and making sure that sport is inclusive, making sure that sport welcomes everybody. And then it also promotes the event organizers to ensure there are activities, coordinated schedules, and logistics are all accessibility with top of mind as well.
So are there ever any challenges in coordinating these events?
Yeah. A lot of times it's finding other athletes to compete against that fall within your classification. So making sure that there's opportunities for athletes of all classification levels, all abilities, and all skill levels to compete against athletes that are in a similar category or speed or strength category. So for a lot of our athletes here, find that when we go to a lot of the meets, terms, competitions, that there is not a lot of athletes with disabilities represented by other clubs or groups. So our athletes are often looking for opportunities to play against or compete against other athletes in their skill level. In Bolt Hockey, for example, at Variety Village, our athletes have played Bolt Hockey for many years were the only team that were playing. So for our athletes, they were almost getting bored because they were playing against each other so often that there wasn't really a lot of competition. So as the league grew and more teams started to play, Niagara, Barrie, London, each of those groups that are starting to build out their teams, we're finding that the skill levels change, the competition has changed, and the stages change. Not only the way that our athletes are represented, but also in the friendships they're making with other groups and teams of athletes that want to compete as part of their team, and then possibly as part of a provincial team, a national team, and maybe an international team as well.
So, with all the recent happenings, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, I think the one that kind of sticks in my mind most is talking a bit about Bolt Hockey, which is a power cart played by athletes of all abilities. The part that stands out to me the most in this conversation is that there's a lack of power sport available for individuals who use power chairs or mobility devices to participate. So Bolt Hockey really kind of created a new platform for kids and youth to play a sport, compete in a sport that they love and enjoy. And it's been great to kind of watch and cheer on athletes that love hockey and now can play hockey together with their peers. So we're finding that the parents, the guardians, the athletes themselves are really kind of complimenting the fact that there's more power sport opportunities now than before. And we're hoping to grow more opportunities as well through the different adaptive hockey programs that are out there. So many of our members are looking to get involved in a number of different sport programs, especially in the field of hockey. And now there's opportunities to play blind hockey. There's opportunities to play para-ice hockey, bolt hockey, deaf hockey, amputee hockey. There's so many different variables now that our athletes can participate in. And in some cases, some of our athletes participate in more than one hockey league, given kind of their interest and a need to play or participate.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you, Ken.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health or addiction, consider registering to the new REACT program launched by Downtown Windsor Community Collaborative. REACT is a 90-day program committed to understanding your story and supporting your journey to healthy and long-term healing. All sessions are online and completely free, running weekdays from 9 a.m. until noon. Visit reactwindsor.ca and instantly be connected to a safe and supportive community. That's reactwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about Every Canadian Counts from Hubert Van Niekerk, and we got an update on Variety Village from Archie Allison. This next interview was a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Christy Cooper will be telling us about NCDSA. So what can you tell me about the organization and the work with Down Syndrome?
So the North Carolina Down Syndrome Alliance is an organization that supports individuals with Down Syndrome as well as their families. So we focus on full lifespan support for individuals with DS, but we also do lot of support for families, so parents are definitely a big part of that, making sure that as parents receive a Down syndrome diagnosis for their child, that they have some support and some information as they're getting to know what that actually means. We also want to make sure that we're supporting in a way that's different from what medical providers are doing, because today there's still a lot of medical providers who are delivering some information that in some cases is not completely correct. In other cases, it's just incomplete. So we kind of talk to the longer-term outcomes of like what life really looks like. It's really focused on health conditions specifically, and often these diagnosis conversations are very scary and intimidating, and are not really the most helpful. So we want to be here to make sure that we're here to provide accurate information, resources, and connection to those families from, in some cases, before the baby is even here. But we also do focus on things like our learning program, which helps parents to work with their kids directly to enhance whatever education they're getting through, you know, homeschool or public schools, private schools, anything like that. We also have a sit shops program, which is for the siblings of the individuals with Down syndrome so that they can have a little bit of support to gather with each other and kind of talk about the specifics of what it's like to have a sibling with Down syndrome and how your life might look a little bit different because of that. But we go all the way through working on advocating for people with Down syndrome in the workplace and what that looks like and what does supportive employment look like and how amazing can it be to have employees with Down syndrome and what they bring to the table and what employers can do to find that talent and support that talent so that they can do really well in the workforce. And then we also do support even past that. So just answering questions, making sure that resources are out there so that throughout the entirety of an individual with Down syndrome's life, they have a support that can kind of point them to resources, provide connection, and provide other things like opportunities to gather for just fun, relaxing stuff with other people who just get what it's like to either be a person with Down syndrome or to love a person with Down syndrome.
So I'm curious, when you mentioned providing information to new parents of children with Down syndrome, how do you go about providing resources to separate myth from fact? I mean, there's got to be that initial shock factor and the question of, can my child still live a full and meaningful life?
Yeah, there absolutely is. So one, we actually start by trying to talk with providers. So before that patient is even there, we do work on through medical outreach efforts to talk with medical providers who are going to be in any part of the diagnosis conversation, because it's not just an OB or a maternal fetal medicine professional necessarily who's going to have a conversation that's going to stay with that parent. We also try to work with any provider who is going to be touching that family from the start to do our best to provide them with resources and support so that they can actually start that conversation in the best way possible. As far as once the diagnosis conversation starts, we also want to be there to let the parents know that we've been there. My son is 7 and he has Down syndrome, and I very much remember what it was like in those early days of being told that he might have Down syndrome and then going through more testing and wondering the whole time whether that was the case or whether it was not the case, and I was worried and scared for no reason. And there's a lot of power in being able to talk to somebody who's actually walked in those shoes, because it is such a unique position to be in as you walk through that path of trying to figure out whether your child does have DS and what that might mean for your family. So a big part of what we do is once the diagnosis conversations start, we do hope that those medical providers that we've been trying to connect with will think of us and let us know that the parent is, you know, receiving this diagnosis, and help us connect with them so that we can actually get a parent mentor connected with them. So that's our first call program, and that is where we connect. It's usually moms, but we do for dads and other parents as well. But we want to get those folks connected to others who have been in those shoes in the past few years, so that it's kind of a similar, probably, conversation that they're having to the one that their mentor had. So that's a big part of it, is getting those folks connected, because a lot of times they really want to hear from somebody who's been in their shoes. So we do a lot of work to train those parent mentors so that they're not just speaking from their own experience, but hopefully they also have some resources themselves. And if they don't have those resources or don't feel comfortable sharing all of that, we do have a family support specialist, and that is what she does. So she is a wealth of information. She's the one who does the connections between the mentors and the mentees. But she's also kind of our face of the first call program, so that when that person is receiving that diagnosis, that she can be there and provide them with whatever they want at that time, because everybody's in a different place too. Some people want a ton of info, some people want none, and a lot of people want something in between, and they take their time moving through different stages of how they're processing. And so she is there to kind of navigate that process, whatever it looks like with that particular parent, and make sure that we get as much connection and as many resources as are helpful to that family as they move through that process.
So, in your time with the Alliance, has there been any success moment or story, either from someone receiving services or somebody working within the organization? Story that
Great question. Yeah, so in my time, so I've been here as a staff member, as the assistant director for the past 2 months, just celebrated my second month. So I am still learning what it's like to be part of the staff, but I have been supported by this organization for about 7.5 years at this point. And I can tell you that, you know, one of the success stories, I guess, in connection, especially in those early days, is our family. So we were in a different place than some folks. Some parents that I speak with are ready to start talking with other parents and get a bunch of information just as soon as they hear the words Down syndrome. My husband and I were not in that place when we started having these conversations. And one of the great things that NCDSA did for us is they kind of let us take the lead on where we were, so that they weren't just kind of providing a bunch of stuff and then saying, okay, here's, you know, this is what you need because you're going to be having a kid with Down syndrome. So this is, you know, here's the packet and you're good to go. They actually made several offerings to us as far as what the next connection point for us might be. And one of those was a researcher here at the University of North Carolina. My husband and I did not feel like talking to other parents yet. We kind of felt like they were probably in a very different place where they felt like everything was, you know, sunshine and rainbows, and we were not feeling like that. And so we actually wanted to talk to somebody who was not a parent. And that was one of the most useful conversations I've ever had in my son's lifetime, of just being able to have a conversation with somebody who had some facts to bring forward. That's what we wanted. She walked us through by asking us, what do you know about Down syndrome? And went from there to then let us give that lead of, this is where we are, this is what we know, how can you fill in the gaps here to give us a better picture of what life looks like. We're still connected to that researcher. She actually came back a couple years later and included us in some of the research that she's doing for a study going on right now. And so it's been a great relationship that we've had going forward. And that information that she shared with me is something that I continue to share with other parents who I mentor, as well as just things that come up as we navigate my son's life. And we're in the thick of first grade right now since he's 7. And so some of the things that she shared with us are things that I'll even be able to bring into our IEP meetings to make that a more productive conversation with his educational team now.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Christy touched on an absolutely critical point in disability life, the essential process of guiding someone through a new diagnosis. Understanding what it might mean to them and to their family is critical. Anyone can read in a textbook and get a cold, hard set of facts that say it means this, this, and this. But understanding a person's strength, understanding that there might be a uniqueness to their situation, can provide some hope. When you accept that it's not a hopeless battle, and that everyone reacts a little differently, and depending upon the support systems, they might find strength. You come to see the world isn't such a harsh place in disability life. It is, in fact, about both a new way of thinking and a great sense of community. People tend to pull together to share resources, to share information, to share ideals in the disabilities realm. And that is where it all begins. The understanding that this is not yours to carry alone. A person with a disability may rise to the occasion, or they may knuckle under. They may say, this is hopeless. It all depends on the strength of the individual and those around them. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, We're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.